Welcome to the History of California podcast. I'm your host, Jordan Maddox. Today we have Catherine Nichols on the show. Catherine is the author of the book Deep Water, which covers the true story of the drug ring started by a group of swim team surfers on the island of Coronado in Southern California. It's a fascinating thrill ride of a story and covers a lot of interesting history that connects to different parts of California. Catherine is a journalist and a fascinating conversation partner, and I know you'll love this episode. Let's go meet Catherine Nichols. Catherine, is Deep Waters a beach read?
Oh, yes, for sure it's a beach read. It's
What's your definition of a good beach read?
fast-paced, pretty easy to get through. Read it in two sittings, even one, if you're enjoying a few hours in the sand, for sure. I love it for a beach read.
Yeah, it's both a beach read and also a story that takes place on the beach. What was it like growing up on Coronado?
It was idyllic. It was like an era and a place that I don't think will ever be replicated, because we rode our bikes around all over town. We went to the beach all day. We played in the surf. It was incredible. And even though I was after the time of these guys, it was still like that. There were no cell phones, obviously. You went over to people's houses. You rode your bike around town to figure out what was going on and who was around and who could come out and play. It was just perfect.
And you grew up a swimmer as well, correct? How did that background in swimming, and we'll get more into the biography of some of the characters in this story, but how did that affect your perception of this story? Just thinking about how far they swam and the abilities that it took to accomplish that.
I think my background as a swimmer is enormously important in my writing of the book, because I started swimming. I was thrown into the pool very young because it was important to my parents, who were both swimmers. My father was a Navy SEAL and my mother was a long distance swimmer. So that was definitely an essential piece.
Genetic too, I'm sure.
I don't know about that, but certainly people have asked me, oh, when did you learn to body surf? And I said, I don't know. It was just something I learned so young. It was something I felt like I always knew how to do, like learning to walk. It was inherent. But when I was about seven, I had a lot of trouble with asthma when I was a kid. And my parents took me to a sort of progressive doctor who suggested that I start swimming. And they're like, great, the kid's not going to drown. Like, they just dropped me off at the pool with the swim team. And that was that. So I started swimming competitively when I was seven and then was doing rough water swims. And my familiarity and comfort in the ocean and my understanding of surf and tides and currents and waves and all of those pieces just factored tremendously in my ability to write about swimming miles across the border and in these certain areas and what it felt like and just how the experience might have unfolded for these guys. So I think that was very helpful.
Another commonality you have is your schooling. You went to Coronado High School. I think it would be wonderful to start with just a description of what it's like, because it's going to feature prominently in the story, and how close your experience of it was to theirs.
That's a really good question. I think even though they were more than a decade ahead of me, the experiences were probably fairly similar because there hadn't been that much change during that time. So again, idyllic town, idyllic place, people rode their bikes to school. It was a good school. It was considered a good school. And I'll say that back in those days, especially in good public schools in Southern California, you had a problem if you were in a private school. That meant you had a drug issue or some sort of psychiatric issue. I don't mean to, let's cut that.
Yeah.
Private school, it meant that you most likely had encountered some problems, whereas the good public schools were well respected. So I think the experiences were similar. Now, I will say that my mother went to Coronado High School in the 50s. These guys were in Coronado High School in the 60s and 70s, and then I was later. And it was incredible. It was a really fantastic experience. So I think that knowledge certainly helped me understand where they were coming from, understand all the pieces, and really delve into the minds and hearts of the characters.
Okay, let's jump into the story itself. How is the story told on the island? And there's a second dimension to this question I want to ask. Who is the group or stakeholder community on the island that is perceived to be the authoritative tellers of this story? Sometimes in small towns, there are like slices of the population that own a story or are the ones that tell it, and then their version becomes the definitive version. So I'm curious about folklore on the island about this story and who's telling it.
Very good question, because I would say that's a there's a multifaceted answer to that, because you have these conflicting elements in Coronado that all have a different perspective on the story. For example, you have this beach town, a somewhat privileged area because it's a very nice place to live. Even back in the day when most of the houses were kind of cottages, it was still a lovely place to live. So you have that element and people smoking pot, having parties on the beach around the bonfire, that sort of party element, surfers, people lying around on the beach, all of that. That's one piece. Then surrounding Coronado, you have the military. So on one side, you have the amphibious base where the Navy SEALs trained. On the other side, you have North Island Naval Air Station, where again, where all the pilots were training. And then, of course, that evolved into Top Gun at Miramar. You have aircraft carriers docked on another part of that. So essentially, it's surrounded by military. And that could give a completely different perspective. There were also a lot of old-time people in Coronado. So I was essentially fourth generation. My mother grew up there. My grandmother lived there. My great grandmother lived there for a while. And so the people who are old time Coronado didn't really particularly like this story. It spoils the idyllic notion of this beautiful place to live and grow up and raise your kids. But it percolated nonetheless. And certainly I'd heard it when I was going to school. From a very young age, I dated a lifeguard who worked with Eddie Otero. I knew people, again, in classes farther ahead than I was, who were asked to swim but had promising futures, so declined. So there were little bits and pieces of the story. Also, I'll say that I grew up in Bob Lahodney's house. So Bob Lahodney was one of the primary partners, the one who brought in the Thai stick from Thailand. So I grew up in his house. So that was present for me all the time. And of course, my father was a judge later on, and his chambers were next to a judge who, as the DA, had prosecuted these guys. So you can see that all of these different pieces started to unfold. And all of the people in the book that I wrote, I knew personally, pretty much, or interviewed them. So there was direct contact with all of the elements. And Coronado itself is a character, I believe, in the book. It really plays a role because it's the time during the Vietnam War, it's the place, this idyllic sort of isolated location, all play a role in how this evolved.
And what were the circumstances in which it became a professional activity for you, in which you wanted to start to think about producing something from this story? I know you mentioned in some interviews that you started thinking about the early 90s. Can you take us through the inception of the idea and then when you started really doing research?
Yeah, I've been a professional writer for decades, for a long time. So it was in that time period that I thought, this story just keeps coming up for me and I want to write something about it. But I didn't think that I could do the, at that time, do the true story because it just getting, pulling all the pieces together, what would be allowed to be said publicly versus not. And so I decided to fictionalize it. And so I made the girl the prime main character who started swimming and wrote this whole book. And unbelievably, the reaction to it from publishers at the time was that, oh, you know what? We don't want to do anything with drugs, if you can imagine that. So there was a lot of resistance initially. And I put it aside. And by that time, I had a pretty flourishing career as a professional writer in magazines, newspapers. I was a staff writer. I did a TV show throughout Hawaii and the Pacific Islands, kind of an adventure travel type show series with many episodes. And so I just set it aside. And then later on, when I had another agent, she asked me, "What else do you have?" Because she was working with me on a different project. And I said, "I did this book a while ago." And she said, "Let me see it. Give me 60 pages." And she took it to Simon and Schuster, and they said, "Oh my goodness, we love it, but we want her to start over and write the true story." And by this time, I had many years of investigative journalism under my belt, so I was much better equipped to start tracking people down and writing the true story. But it was still a quick deadline.
Yeah, let's jump into that research process. What was it like when you had broached this subject with members of the community? And you, is this like a skeleton that you're digging up? Is that how it was perceived? Or were people excited to talk about it in the sense that it was this kind of huge event that happened on the island? How do people talk about it?
I would say that reluctance was the primary reaction. They didn't really want to talk about it too much. A few people who were close to me or close to the situation were a little more willing, but I had to do the journalistic piece where you reach out to one person, then you reach out to the next, then you reach out to the next, and you just keep trying. And sometimes people gave you plenty of information, and sometimes they didn't. But I tracked down all of the teachers at the time, people who, relatives who would be willing to talk to me. Some people just weren't. But a lot of people were. And unbelievably, the smugglers themselves were much more willing than I initially thought they would be. And it was when I talked to the DEA as well. And when I asked them about it, they said, "You know what? The thing is, these guys were really good at it and they love to tell their story." So that once I opened the gates, then everything flowed from there. I was able to get quite a few anecdotes and stories and bits and pieces. But I will say that when I went to when I had the book launch, all hundreds of people came, DEA, IRS, smugglers, the widow of Eddie, the cop who tipped off the DEA, all kinds of people. And people could say, "It was like this and it was like that." And I said, "I'm sure you know that this is all subjective. I do have court records and I do have all the DEA records. I tracked all of those things down, which were quite, difficult to get. You have to write a letter and send a check and get, these are not digitized records. So you have to get mounds of paper back. But if I interviewed 10 people, I got 10 different versions. So I had to settle on the most common one each time."
So let's talk about historiography, which is just a fancy way of saying what's been written before. So, what was the landscape before you started writing, not your first version, but the second version? I know that there have been some magazine features about it, and there's some news stories, television programs. Can you talk about the landscape of what was written before your book arrived?
Yeah, 60 Minutes had done something in the 80s that was pretty extensive and fairly well done, although he only talked to minor people. 60 Minutes had done something in the 80s, but they talked to people who were not the principals because they were all tied up in court dealings at that time.
Sure.
So they talked to offloaders and people like that, but it was still, I think, a worthwhile piece and they did a great job with it. So that was certainly helpful and served as a resource. Joshua Behrman had done an article, which I thought was really well done. He's a super writer. And I even went back to Simon and Schuster and said, "Someone has done this. Do you want me to do it again?" And they said, "Absolutely. We want it completely different. We want you to do it from the perspective of someone who grew up around this and in this place and make it a narrative nonfiction book." So rather than a magazine article, it's nonfiction, but reads like a novel. But
Let's talk about that choice. Why did you choose to go that route as opposed to something that's more straightforward history? And you can add elements of excitement and thrill to narrative nonfiction. Yours is more focused on dialogue, and you're in the scenes rather than an omniscient person, a narrator above the scene. So why did you make that choice?
I didn't. Simon Schuster
Okay. Why do you think
did.
that's the right choice? Because you agreed to do it. So why do
I
you think
did
that's
agree to
a
do it. I did, because I thought that could be really fun. That's an interesting challenge to have it read and unfold like a novel, and yet I'm really constrained. So if it were a novel, I would have done quite a few things differently, just not having all the different characters, three or four DEA agents unfolding. I would have had one, so there was more of a cat and mouse that was focused. But I would say that it worked because they wanted it to read like a novel and have a thrill to it. And yet, I still had to walk through it with fact checkers and lawyers and make sure that every piece and tell them all of the proof that I had for each varying piece. And yet, a lot of the characters are dead. And I call them characters, they're people, right? I'm referring to them as characters just in this narrative nonfiction format. But these people are no longer alive. So I can't go verify, did they have this dialogue exchange in this way? But I used all the information to put everything together from all the different bits and pieces I heard. And for example, when Bob Lahodney and Eddie are coming into the house, like that was my house. That was where I grew up. So I could write all of that. I knew about all of the different pieces and talk to people who had been around when the bridge was finished and what Coronado was like and how it changed this small town from this place that had one stoplight to being connected to a bigger city and all of the sociological ramifications of that.
How did you choose to think about dialogue, writing dialogue in this book? Because it seems like you could load the dialogue in such a way where you're giving premonitions or gesturing towards where the plot's going to go that might not have been the way it was communicated in the moment between the characters. How did you conceptually think about writing this dialogue?
I thought about it by really going deep into the people. So I did my research super, super carefully and extensively on each person. And without trying to capture too much of the exact way they would speak and trying to make them drug smugglers, because they weren't. So in essence, you might read it and say, this is formal for a bunch of drug smugglers. So they were upper middle class people in a suburb of San Diego. So a lot of them were educated. And so they didn't speak like that. But I really approached it by going deep into the individual characters and people and thinking about what they would say to one another that would be realistic based on all the interviews that I did, but also convey a forward movement of this incredible story.
Okay. So right at the beginning of your book, you have a kind of a cast of characters where you lay out each of the different characters and their role in the story. There's so many, it almost resembles a large ensemble in a Shakespeare play. Why did you want to have such a wide scope? It seems like you could have perhaps narrowed your cast of characters down a bit. Why was it important to include all of these individuals in the story, even in minor roles?
Unbelievably, I left a lot out. In fact, some of them, the lesser known people in the operation came back to me and said, I should have been there more. So I think that it was important because I tried to list everybody who had a significant role in the operation. And I will call it a team because Lou was a coach. He was a teacher and coach, and he had the unique skill of gathering people and assembling a team where each person had a specialized role. And in those specialized roles, for example, like Don Kidd and Fuzzy, for example, these guys were minor, quote unquote, minor characters. They weren't partners. And yet, when it came to the dealings off of Maine on Little Machias Bay, where they literally had this winch and pulley system pulling loaded trucks up the side of a cliff and lowering them down empty, pulling them up full. They built these Kevlar barges where they were tendering the whatever they were doing at that time. It was various things like Moroccan hashish or Thai stick or not Mexican marijuana to Maine, but various products. whatever they were doing, these guys played an essential role. And I did interview them, so I felt compelled to list everybody. It was, hopefully it doesn't get too confusing in the book. I feel like you focus on Eddie, Lou, Dave, and Lance, who are the primary players, and everybody else is just a bit player who comes in various
Yeah,
places.
I only found myself flipping back to the cast of characters a few times because it has a narrative propulsion to it that kind of keeps you on task. And sometimes when you're reading a book with a large cast of characters, you might forget a character's role, but as the plot unfolds, their function becomes clear.
And for
Let's.
example, I would have, like, for Bob Lahodney, who disappears for a while, well, that really happened. Now, if I had been writing fiction, I wouldn't have had him disappear. But I felt deeply compelled to stick to the facts of how what unfolded when. And so that was part of including, and again, I did leave a lot of people out because the indictment in 1977 listed something like 24 people, and there weren't 24 names listed there.
Okay, let's jump into some of these characters. I want to start with the early characters, these young entrepreneurs. Beyond surfing, what did they have in common with each other?
Coronado. But they all had a love of the ocean, which I correlate Coronado and a love of the ocean because people just understood the ocean very well. So even, like, for example, Lance, who had tried to smuggle a little bit on in his surfboard. They would load up surfboards and drive them across the border and then try to paddle them, et cetera. He wasn't that great in the ocean compared to the other guys, but he understood motors and boats. And Lou had been a surfer, again, not that much, but he understood the ocean as well. So I feel like the tie was this sort of trust that came from living in this small town together at in a certain period of time and understanding the ocean, which is what made them unique and gave them the ability to go around the border crossings during Nixon's war on drug, which is really what tightened the land crossings and made it much more difficult to get across. And I don't know, there was just this feeling, even today, if I run into someone I hear who lived in Coronado or grew up in Coronado, there is an immediate connection. And we have something special to talk about, even if I've never met the person.
Okay, let's talk about the early operations because they started out not very sophisticated. Could you describe the approach initially? And then if you could describe what is it actually like to swim, paddle, travel via ocean without some kind of boat, just on your own steam? I'm curious, have you done it since you wrote the, just to, not saying you've crossed the border illegally, but have you tried to go up the coast of California north of the border just to experience what that's like?
Sure. Yeah, I've
Yeah.
done it a lot. Yeah, I've swum around Coronado. I was a relay, but I've been in, yes, I absolutely grew up swimming in the ocean and doing workouts out in the ocean, so I know
Yeah.
exactly what it's like.
Yeah, I would love to have you describe that so you can give people a picture.
Well, I will say I didn't do it at night.
Yeah, that's a terrifying element. No,
That
yeah.
is a very terrifying. So people like, could I do it? Could a lot of people do it who are decent swimmers? Sure. Could you do it swimming that far out at night? With the risk of all the great whites floating around in there, that's another matter. So there's a definitely a terrifying element to it. And let's go back to your initial question, which
Yeah.
is initially, how did they begin? Very haphazard, I would say. It was more like, let's make a few bucks, let's get some weed for our friends, we'll have enough for the bonfire party. It was small time. It was started by Lance Weber and another kind of friend of his, who both of them turned out got kicked out of the operation later on because of they were using drugs and ended up tipping off the DEA later on after they were kicked out, but that's a separate story. It started with Lance just starting to paddle, and then he started to swim, and he did not have the ability to do the swimming very well. So he targeted Eddie because Eddie was a superior swimmer. He was a great water polo player. He was a lifeguard, which means he knew the surf and the tides and the currents and all the pieces to navigate. So swimming in the ocean on your own volition requires navigation. And that's a big deal to learn to know how to navigate, to know how to lift your head up, to know what are you spotting? What are you using to guide you? Are you feeling the current pulling you in another direction? If you're not too far off the coast, you can always use that. But again, at night, it's a little more difficult. But still, they were just bringing small bundles like 20 pounds, 25 pounds, either tied to the ankle or on a crossbody strap that a lifeguard would use, and in waterproof bags so they floated. And that was it. And gradually they started to scale the operation using small inflatables because they saw, of course, the Navy SEALs were using these IBS inflatable boats, small training, and that gave them the idea. And of course, then the Lance had this knowledge of boat and motors, and so they went to use to catch. And then eventually we're doing 130 foot boats with big giant holds to bring in these massive shipments.
Yeah, one thing as I was thinking about when I was reading, it was like, it would be like trying to commit a crime across the street from a police station. You're swimming past naval bases along the coast. Like that feels incredibly bold to me, but maybe it's one of those situations where you don't notice what's right in front of your nose. Or how did they think about committing an international drug crime right across the street from a naval base?
I think that was part of the thrill.
Okay.
Like people say, it's all about money. They wanted money. I said, yes, but these guys loved the thrill. They loved the team aspect. They felt like part of a family. They discovered they were really good at it. They had operational expertise. There was a lot more than money motivating them. At first, it was fun, but I think there was this a quote in there where I said, if Eddie would do it for free, just for the thrill. So that was a piece of it. But one lone swimmer way outside at night isn't going to really attract. You might get the Navy SEALs out there training, doing their night training for the swimming, but it's not going to get noticed. It's when they started using the boats and the sound of motors and coming right up on the beach, which they did near the Hotel Del at some point, that was much riskier. Right past, that's not that far away from the Naval Amphibious Base.
Wild.
Pull up the motor, deflate the boat, throw it into the van, and go.
Okay, let's talk about Lou now. Lou VR or Villar VR. How do you say it?
He pronounced it Villar.
Okay, so let's talk about Lou Villar now, who is a central kind of hinge point in this story. And he's a fascinating character in so many ways to me, starting out as a teacher and then going north to work on boats and then coming back down, having a kind of a commercial painting company. He seems like a wanderer, but he also seems like someone that was looking for something. How do you understand his character and what led him to play such a large role in the story?
You've hit it exactly right. He was all of those things. I think Lou was smart. He had street smarts for sure. Grew up in Cuba, left at a rather young age, and got an education. And I think that maybe not entirely the diploma was forged. So he got the teaching job, but came to be a Spanish teacher at Coronado High School and was loved by the students. He was popular. He was handsome and suave and kind of fun. But he did get into trouble with a lot of the girls really liked him. And I think he ended up marrying one of them right after she graduated. So he definitely was involved with underage girls at the time, which is, of course, maybe I know that the principal at the time knew this and was trying to get rid of him. And so he was essentially asked to leave because of this. And they couldn't really prove anything because nobody would really get involved. And of course, what was happening in that was the late 60s is not today. Very different culture and,
Yeah. Was that his getting in trouble for things like that kind of a stamp of credibility for these young drug runners that he could be someone to be relied on to break rules?
Yeah, I think so. It's like more, he's cool. But they just, and then when he went up, he was going to sail around the world and that whole thing fell apart. So he was definitely struggling and was running out of money. He drove the Corvette and he had the show, but he definitely was struggling a bit by the time he came back to Coronado and was painting houses. And one of the houses was our house. So he was hanging around our house with my mom. I was at the time. So that's all that whole scene was my house.
Jeez, wild.
Yes. Anyway, so yeah, my mom knew him pretty well. Anyway, so he was trying to make his way, but I think he thought he could just make house painting work. But that's when Lance and especially Eddie saw an opportunity because they were struggling to make deals with their supplier down in Mexico because they hadn't paid attention in Spanish class. So Eddie said, you know, what about Lou? Like he can translate, obviously, he's a native speaker. And they're like, I don't know, let me think about it. Can he be trusted? Yeah, he's cool, of course. Okay, so they go recruit him. How about $50 and we'll give you dinner? Come down, translate for us. And he's, why not? And then he has a head for business. He's, no, I see what's going on here. You're doing this all wrong. You're doing lots of small loads, which they were from like 1971 to 1975. He said, you need to do this differently. You need to think bigger, reduce the risk, bigger loads, fewer moves across the border, and we'll make a lot more money. So he pushed his way in. Of course, that's when Lance feels like, uh-oh, I'm losing control of my own operation because Lou is essentially a CEO type.
Yeah, it's a tale as old as time. You have some unsophisticated founders with a great idea, and then you bring in a manager of some type, and then they professionalize activities, and then that original fun element is gone, and then things are professionalized in such a way where they have to change, but they don't want to change. It feels like I've heard this and read this story a number of times. Can you talk about at its zenith how sophisticated this operation was, just to give people perspective on when it became the Coronado Company, if you will.
I think they called themselves the Coronado Companies fairly early, but
Okay.
it wasn't officially labeled by like the DEA until later. But we are talking about some guys swimming, running up the beach with these small bundles, having the line snap, losing the bundles in the surf, running around, throwing it in the VW van, so unsophisticated, just barely escaping the cops and the DEA agents early on who were starting to get wind of what was going on and trying to catch them in the act. At its zenith, these guys were incredibly sophisticated operators. And they were negotiating with major cartels. They were understanding the supply and demand. They were understanding how the economic state of the country was factoring into it. They were bringing product from Thailand and Morocco and obviously Mexico initially, all over the place. And 20 tons was the biggest shipment. So we're talking about 20 pounds to 20 tons of product. But that wasn't even the zenith. The zenith was when they figured out how to bring in the much more potent Thai stick, which allowed them to go down to 6 or 7 tons. So if you bought a ton for $50,000, let's say, and you could sell it for 3 million. So the profit margin was amazing. The potency was much bigger. And they just had all of the economics figured out. They got investors to front money so that they could buy product. They knew exactly how to change bills and move it around the world, cash, because again, TSA was not a thing. And I would say at its zenith, probably were the operations in Maine with these incredibly, they built these custom Kevlar barges to tender from these massive ships out in the ocean that couldn't come any closer because of the rocky coastline. And they would tender these loads in to these trucks and then lift them up. And then they had, boom, they had a communications house, they had a distribution house, they had all of these systems in place to distribute product, collect cash, and pay the suppliers. So it was a pretty big deal.
And they were living large as well. I've seen some of the pictures of the houses as well. I was wondering when I was seeing the pictures of the houses, thinking about the IRS and why they weren't on their tails immediately. Why do you think that was the case?
It took a long time to build the case. It really did. So they finally figured it. It really wasn't until Paul Acree and Lance Weber turned that they were able to get enough evidence to start building a case for an indictment.
So if
And
they didn't turn, what do you think might have happened? How might the story have played out? It would just been a longer investigation, or maybe nothing ever went to trial. What do you think? What, I love counterfactuals. I love to think about how history turns on a single decision. So in your mind, if they don't turn, what happens?
I think that's what they would have been caught eventually because I or been killed because honestly, they were heading out of their league in the 80s with all of these major cocaine cartels. And these guys were trying to be nonviolent. They were trying not to do heroin and cocaine. And they wanted to just stick to marijuana because they thought the consequences would be reduced from the harder drugs. But yeah, I think that they would have gotten caught eventually, but it would have been different. It's interesting because they never were caught in the act, even though the DEA tried and tried. Some of that was because the DEA was newly formed in 1973 and they were getting going and always a step behind. They managed to do the indictment or get the indictment to prepare an indictment in, I think, 77. And the guys were all skiing in Aspen when this came down. And they, at that time, had hired a pretty skilled attorney named Phil DeMassa, who was well known in San Diego circles. Again, I had interviewed all the
He's a
legal.
fascinating character. Can you talk about him for a few minutes? Reading about him, I was like, is this person real?
But first, let me finish the pre
Yeah, of course.
okay. The indictment, they were fugitives. So they were fugitives for years, living large, as you said. They were playing polo in Santa Barbara. They were living in major houses. They owned a bunch of polo ponies. They were donating to charities and to political campaigns and participating in social circles, and they hosted the best parties. So they were very much living large, which contributed to the IRS case because I actually had the IRS agent at my book launch, and he's the one who really put together the case with the DEA to bust them. They also did some silly things like order these Mercedes 450 SELs 6.9s that were not available actually on the open market. And of course, then they were like, okay, so we have a retired teacher and a lifeguard and some sort of man about town, Bob Lahodney, not really doing much of anything, owning the most expensive cars. And it was a signal that they were into something big.
Yeah.
So Phil DeMassa was a fascinating person. And I would actually love to do a whole book on him because he's super interesting. He defended a lot of smugglers, various cartel people throughout the years. So the legal community in San Diego particularly, wanted Phil DeMassa out. So that actually contributed to Lou's ability to make a deal when, of course, he'll throw anybody under the bus. Eddie's the person who would never throw anybody under the bus. Lou will throw anybody under the bus to get out of jail sooner. And he, threw his attorney under the bus at some point. That was how he's able to make a deal. But DeMassa just was an all cash lawyer. He knew every loophole. He knew all the rules. He was slippery and clever and actually died a very mysterious death in Hawaii. No one quite knows what happened. Yeah,
Wow.
on a boat with a couple of women. But anyway, he was on the 60 Minutes piece as well. So that was an interesting interview.
One of the things I was surprised about was the length of some of these sentences that they received. It felt pretty light relative to things that I've read about. Why is that?
DeMassa, I think
Just
DeMassa,
effective legal representation.
effective legal representation, that's one piece, but they made deals. They
Yeah.
made deals. So it was all hinging on giving the DEA and the US attorney some information that was useful. And they did. The only person who didn't was Eddie. And so he stayed in longer. I think Lou and Dave got out in something like 18 months to 2 years initially. And so
Wild.
yeah, I know. I know. And I will say, people said, oh, what happened to the money? Because it was seized at the end, all the cash that had they got a little, there's a little bit of hubris involved, of course. Oh, we'll take care of it. They had rules before. Never keep any cash, never keep any product at your house. And he got a little lax at the end, and they got busted, and all of this was seized at Lou's house. And that, of course, helped move things along. But they turned in all kinds of people and got out early and had stashed money elsewhere. Art collections, wine collections, real estate in other people's names, their parents' names, friends' names, et cetera. So there were little pockets of money that they could call upon, but they never lived large again.
Yeah. There's so many interesting elements to this story. I think one of the ones to take a 20,000 foot perspective for a second is a lot of the stories we tell about the drug trade feature cartels as the antagonists. And this is a story of well-to-do surfer bums developing this kind of complicated drug operation that made them wildly wealthy. And it just doesn't fit within the broader discourse. And so I'm curious about, do you think there is a race element to this? Do you think there is a socioeconomic element to this, both in the length of their sentences, but how the stories are told? And it doesn't seem like your story fits the mold. And I'm curious how that kind of complicates our picture of what it means to be in the drug trade in California.
Very interesting observation, because yes, I'm sure all of those pieces were factors. It's a bunch of, aside from Lou, who's Cuban, everybody's white. Everybody's somewhat privileged. Everybody came from families in Coronado where people knew each other. They knew their parents, you knew the siblings. Did that factor into making a sentence lighter? I would, if I interviewed the legal people, they'd say no, but we can't possibly understand all the nuances. The time. So by the time they started in, they started, I would say late 60, but 1971, let's call it. That's when Eddie got involved. 73, the DEA's formed. And of course, Nixon's war on drugs is in full force. People are returning from Vietnam addicted. There's this real public enemy number one, drugs. So there's this whole thing. And then of course, that's in direct conflict with the sexual revolution and all of the cultural aspects of the 70s. Then we move into the 80s, and they actually get caught in 1981. So again, we're like, the culture is shifting by that point. But yeah, all of those pieces play a role. And I think that's what makes the story so interesting, because there are so many cartel stories, there are so many narco stories that are fascinating to watch. But this is different, and that's why it's particularly interesting. Like, the why, the motivation. That's why I really wanted to delve into the psychology of it, that it is not just, these are not people poverty-stricken going out because they have no other alternatives. They want something different, more, better. And that in itself is a fairly universal desire.
Let's continue with kind of 20,000 foot perspective. What does this story teach us about what Coronado is?
This story teaches us, I think, about any place that can be a geographical and cultural bubble, if you will. And that's, we call it the bubble. And it seems protected, sheltered, safe, different, privileged. And again, I don't, when I say privileged, I don't mean that everybody's rich there. That's not the case at all. But it still was a privileged existence, free of crime for the most part, free of anything except going to school and going to the beach and living in relative safety. So I think it's not just Coronado, but it's any place that could be sheltered, and what can happen in an environment like that. First of all, anything's possible anywhere. It just, oh, that doesn't happen. And that was a big refrain. Those two types of things don't happen in Coronado. It's actually, they do. They can happen anywhere. And sometimes when people grow up in these sheltered, privileged environments, they want that thrill. They want that danger. They want to break out. And Eddie, I know, when he finally was all over the world, carrying cash, fixing boats, meeting with criminals, negotiating with cartels, doing all the things that nobody else could possibly do, when that all came to an end and he tried to go straight, he and Bob couldn't, and ended up going back to it, got set up, and of course went to jail again. But then even later, I talked to his widow, and she said that finally, when she finally figured out what he had done, he just said, God, I miss those days. He missed the excitement and the thrill.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think there's probably a larger cultural analysis to be had there, but I do feel like Coronado is an example. It's a microcosm of what could be any small town. and what could happen where. Breaking Bad was fictional, but it's like the whole Albuquerque thing. You know, what can happen there with a little family and a guy who was a teacher. And again, fictionalized, but still, it worked in the story. So it's, I think it all comes down to the place plays a role, but it's always about people's desires, what they want and what they're willing to do to get it.
This is a California history podcast, and I would be remiss if I didn't ask you how writing this book has changed your perspective on California history, if any.
I don't think it's changed my perspective on California history. It's just, it enhanced my understanding of pieces of it. Certainly, they used all of California because people say, oh, it started in Coronado, but it didn't stay there for very long because, to your point, they did figure out, wow, we're awfully close to law enforcement. They're on to us. We know that. We're going by naval bases. It's a little too much and a little too hot, and everybody knows everybody's business there. That's the essence of a small town. So they started moving up the coast and living North County, changing houses, doing the next two deliveries were, the big deliveries were in Malibu. Then they went way up to Northern California, to the Lost Coast. Then they went to up to Nea Bay, which was one of the last ones. And of course used Maine. I don't know. I think that the history of California is all about new frontiers, fearlessness, wide open spaces, this massive ocean, which it's about space to experiment, to try, to take risks. And I feel like that's the essence of California.
Said, I want to ask you, I just did an interview with Taylor Killand about her book, which is also a crime that happened on the island. And reading your book as companion books was interesting because my familiarity with Coronado is from the 90s on, when I would go visit my grandparents lived in San Diego in Escondido. And so I would go down, and it was always way too hot in Escondido. So we'd get in the car and go to Coronado, and we'd go to the Hotel Del, or we'd go find one of the few beaches around the island that we could just waddle down to as kids. And then a few years ago, I went to and stayed on Coronado. My sister-in-law lives in San Diego as well. And it's just a really kind of wealthy retirement community now is what it what I perceived it to be. And I'm curious where you think Coronado's headed. Is Coronado just going to be a smattering of naval families and then just wealth? Is that what Coronado's becoming in your mind?
Well, that's a really good question as well, because I haven't lived there in a while, but I go back quite frequently to visit. And it was always a simple town, which is just these small, they call them Palmer houses. And it was near a polo field. And again, the beach, and the Hotel Del was built in the late 1800s. So that was around for a long time. But again, it was just a simpler place back then. And the Navy families, they have Navy housing. So some Navy families would live in town, but some would live on the base. So that, there was a mix, and there are different various places in the Strand and et cetera, where Navy families could live. But I think that there was this infusion of wealth that came along that changed it dramatically. And so all of these fun, cute little houses were mowed down, and these enormous places have been built, which is why the historic register has become so important. So the house I grew up in was an historic house, so it couldn't be bulldozed and rebuilt. It has to stay the way it was. You can change the inside, but you can't change the exterior. So I think that you have a few of those houses, but no, there's just an incredible influx of wealth. A lot of people from Arizona and other hot places come and they rent houses for the summer for, doesn't matter, whatever it costs, $30,000 a month, whatever it is. And, or I'm sure a lot more. I've seen them for a lot more than that. So it's definitely changed in that regard. And, but there's still the local families that have lived there and grown up there and have been there for generations. And that actually has become more of a big deal. So when you connect with people, like a lot of my classmates, parents, grandparents live there. And so that is, it's become more important I think, for people who live in Coronado to have that history, to have that knowledge, to have that experience as new people with tremendous wealth come in. Because honestly, it's a quite and it's becoming a very expensive place to live now.
Yeah, those are the exact terms I was thinking about. If you mow down a community and then build mansions on top of bungalows where so much happened, who in the community keeps that history? And I know Coronado has a historical society, but I think this is true for a lot of cities in the United States. So like thinking about municipal history or city history, who creates it and why, and how do you make sure it's preserved so you have a sense of place when you're living somewhere? I think those are the questions that I like to broach a lot in these kinds of conversations. And we could probably do another whole episode on that, but we're going to close right now with book recommendations. What are a few books you'd like to recommend to listeners?
Oh, you mean so current books or old books?
Anything, anything, anything you like. It could be history, it could be San Diego related, it could be just personal.
Okay. Interesting. I just finished The Women by Kristen Hanna. And that actually, the Coronado's featured quite a bit in there. Not perfectly, but
Yeah, I don't know where she lives. It's not
number one
Coronado.
best.
Yeah.
But I thought she did quite a beautiful job illuminating the Vietnam experience, starting in Coronado with the military history and tracing this one girl's journey through becoming a nurse in Vietnam and what happened afterwards. I thought that was well done. Yeah. So I wish I'd known. I would have thought of some other ones that, like, what
Oh,
am I reading now?
that's okay.
I'm also reading, oh my gosh, I'm just drawing a blank on the book.
What about this? Were there any books that you read that helped you with any of your research in this? Is there anything in that domain that you can think of?
No, I can't think of anything offhand that was I wanted to go back to, because we'll cut a lot of that nonsense there, but I wanted to go back to the importance of oral history, because you
Yeah.
talked about the essence of Coronado. And to me, the essence of Coronado is in the people who have been there and who hold its memories and the experiences. So while I did look at every book I could, I went to the Hotel Del, I went to the Historical Society, I went everywhere and got my hands on anything I could find to research. The real gold was in the people and tracking down people who had lived there for multiple generations and the stories that they tell. So in essence, it goes back to that sense of oral history that's so important. Yeah. Yeah.
To close, what are you working on next?
Oh, I have a new short story out, which actually features a female drug smuggler. Someone asked me to redo that. That's in a surfing magazine. So it goes back to that original story. It's all come first full circle. And I have another book, a fiction book that I'm working on that is features, it goes from LA to Hawaii and is kind of succession, and it's a medical legal thriller that I think will be lots of fun. So
Ooh,
lots of things I'm working on. And I just
sounds
started
like.
that with some essays and some new stories and old stories, which I'm really excited about.
Sounds like you're just always working on some beach reads for us, something that we can pick up on our towels and the hot sand and get lost. I'm looking forward to those. Catherine, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me.
Thank you so much for having me. It was really wonderful to talk about this again, and I appreciate your interest.
Thanks for listening, everyone. If you enjoyed this podcast, please consider supporting us by either giving us a rating and review or by making a financial contribution at our Patreon page, which is www.patreon.com/historyofcalifornia. We'll see you next time.